I have one book that's published and one that's on the way. So, okay. Yeah.
What's the name of your published
book? It's The Propeller Under the Bed, Personal History of Home-Built Aircraft. And so it's a history of home-built aircraft, but it's also a story about my dad. He had the idea in college to, he designed an airplane in college to set a world distance record. And it took him 50 years, but he finally set the record in 2010 when he was 82 years old.
Wow.
So it kind of weaves the two stories together. So, yeah. And then my second book is about a pilot, a Navy pilot who was shot down in Vietnam, so, and his rescue. And so, yeah.
So do you personally know this story, or is it something that you researched?
Yeah, I met him from another article I was writing for Air and Space Magazine on the F-8, mm-hmm. and I kind of tripped over him while I was writing that article, and I said, you know, this could make a great book. And mm-hmm. So it's going to be published next year by Potomac Press. So.
Okay, very good. Now, I know the experiences we have when we fly, you know, there's always emergencies and how you handle them. And this afternoon, Casey's story was just incredible, you know, to have the mindset the calmness to go through the steps and pull on that training, on that experience, and get through that. If you didn't hear her story, it's amazing. But my question is, I know you flew for an hour before you actually landed the aircraft. In that hour, you had so much time, it seemed like forever, I'm sure. You know, 1 hour felt like several. What was going through your mind? You know, I don't know if your wingman Lee was talking you through, getting you through that flight to get you back home. How was that?
An hour is a very long time to contemplate what might happen. And so we really tried to focus. We probably did the same emergency checklist over and over again. But there was time, you know, certainly where my mind wandered about what could happen, what might happen, am I making the right decision? And that was tough, and that was, you know, you just try to compartmentalize and bring everything back to the task at hand. But it was tough. It's a long time to contemplate that you may not survive the situation. And so we really, again, with my flight lead, my wingman with me, we went through checklists, we talked about our plan of action, you know, but there was some quiet time too where we were both probably thinking about, you know, the what ifs, what should we do, reevaluating. But it was tough. I think, you know, the thing about that, having that moment so early in my career helped me focus on what my priorities were in life, and it really made me realize things that I wanted to do, family, you know, just it set my priorities straight. And so I'm thankful that I had the opportunity so early in my career to just kind of refocus what's important.
Wow. So, any huge emergencies that you went? Well, being a test pilot, you know, backseater there, I'm sure.
A flight test.
Right. How did those go for you? And were there any moments that you weren't prepared for what was going to happen?
I never had any major emergencies myself in an aircraft. Probably the scariest moment I ever had was when I was on the C-17 program, and I was sitting in the control room. We were on a very early flight of the program, and we had an unplanned reversion into the manual backup system of the airplane, and it was a test point that wasn't supposed to be flown for many, many months, and all of a sudden here we are on the third flight with a configuration that we haven't done all the buildup for and everything. And it was everything turned out okay. But I remember I was sitting there, and all of a sudden, you know, we're just all looking at our strip charts and everything, and all of a sudden the flight controls engineer goes, we're in manual backup. And you could have heard a pin drop in that control room. I mean, everybody was just like, what? There's no way. And then about 5 seconds later, one of the test pilots came on and said, it looks like we're in manual backup. And we're like, yeah. So, you know. And so it's like, you know, don't touch anything, you know, let's talk about this and you know, kind of working the way through it. So, so you know, one of the things about testing is you have a very large team often helping you. So you're in fact, I've often said that one of the safest places to be is doing a hazardous test point, because you've usually got multiple people chasing you in the air, you've got people on the ground looking at all the parameters, you've got experts everywhere to help you solve the problem and get you on the ground. So so there are scary moments, but we have processes to work through those to keep everybody safe. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Lorraine?
No.
No? Oh, wow.
Like I said, you know, it's just
life is good.
I mean, you know, the diversions for a medical, but they're not an emergency. You've got your checklist, you're trained, you know what you're supposed to do. You just go and do what you're supposed to do, and it usually leads you right to where you need to be. So very good training. If you've got the good training, then it just happens.
Very good. So you were able to handle, obviously, all the emergencies. You're sitting with us, you know, your takeoff equals your landings, you're good to go. That's the important thing, you know, as long as you don't eject out of an aircraft. But I guess bird strikes, engine failures, structural.
We did hit a little yellow finch one time.
Okay.
We found the feathers, and that's about it. So it's been very uneventful.
Good for you.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, wow. B?
Yeah, I was in the 141, and I was flying downrange during Desert Storm, and we would depart out of a base in Germany, and we would fly down to Riyadh or several bases down in the Saudi Arabian area. And there had been an industry accident, and I think it was maybe Saudia. There was some fire on the inside of the sidewalls, and it had burned the insulation, and it produced a very, very toxic fume and gas, and they were returning. By the time they had the airplane coupled up to land, everyone was dead. The fumes were so toxic, the whole airplane had perished. The airplane ended up landing and stopping, but unfortunately, so it made, I don't know if you guys remember that, it ran rampant through the airlines, it ran rampant through the carriers and the military. And we were all mindful of, that's scary. Because they didn't respond with the appropriate protocol about put your oxygen mask on, seal it, and be sure you take care of yourself and your crew. So we were crossing the Red Sea, and we got this really stingy fumes. So I'm like, oh, yikes. And the protocol was to put your mask on, check in with everybody, be sure they're okay, and then raise the cabin pressure. So basically you're starting to decompress. Well, we're up in the high 30s, and we brought the cabin up as high as we thought we could. We still had tremendous fumes. You know, the load masters were wonderful. They would like take it off and say, nope, still there. So I was like, we are out of ideas. There's orbits. Tankers up in orbit, we'll have to pull one out and get some gas, because we're running out of options here, because we're at 10,000 feet. We can't seem to hold pressure altitude, so we had to descend. Now I'm burning more gas. So the first officer was an amazing chemical engineer, and he said, why don't we, instead of dumping the cabin, raising the cabin altitude, why don't we try to push it down and increase the differential between the external and internal? I'm like, and he goes, I'm a chemical engineer, it pushes fumes back into solution. I'm like, wow, that sounds vaguely, vaguely familiar from a class long, long ago. So, and then there was a loadmaster, young gentleman, 19 years old, and he goes, I know what this smells like. And we had pallets of goods. We had some weaponry, and he jumped around all the pallets, smelling them and looking for them, and he found a large vat of Varathane, which is like, I don't know, like paint thinner or wood treatment that had broken its seal. Oh, and he basically, so I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I got the chemical engineer who has got this amazing, like bizarro option, which really made a lot of sense. And then the loadmaster, young kid, who said, I'll help you with this, found a big hazmat bag, sealed it off, and we basically got to finish the mission. But I'm like, we are going to end up ditching because I don't have enough gas and I don't have a, you could not land at the nearest suitable because we didn't own those fields and we didn't want to land at those mm-hmm. fields. So it was really, it was amazing what goes through your mind. It's either spatial, everything slows down and you go, oh my gosh, we're in trouble. Or you start using the people that are with you in a crew environment and say, so I just said, I'm out of ideas, like someone help me. And the chemical engineer said one thing, the loadmaster said another, and we got this kind of creative problem solving that really saved the mission. We didn't have to pull the tanker out of orbit and get gas and finished our mission and then basically offloaded the Varathane at destination and flew the jet home. So it was like, that is what we look for in a functional crew environment. And Casey had it with her wingman, is like, let's exchange information in a very open and honest manner because we have got to solve a problem that I don't think we've seen before. And you just got to tap all the resources that you have available to you. And it came from places I never expected it to. A 19-year-old young airman. I mean, it was just really, we got on the ground, we had a good debrief, and it was just something that was like, this was remarkable. And we shared it with, of course, our flight standards people to say, hey, this might be something to think about.
Right.
And it did kind of adjust some of our options for this particular malfunction going forward. So.